Coming up next on Passion Struck.
Everybody has a genetic predisposition for type 2 diabetes. And the reason everybody has this is that everybody evolved the ability to manage sugar differently in the autumn in order to prepare them for the winter. Everybody, all humans develop this. Now, some of us have it stronger than others, of course, but every single one of us behaves the same way if we eat too much sugar too consistently for too long a time. We slow our metabolisms down. We increase our cravings for sugar. We start storing excessive amounts of sugar. Our cells start refusing to accept the sugar in, insulin sensitivity problems, and we start storing fat. Pretty much everybody goes through that cycle. The question is, how far can you push it? Some people can't push it that far and they instantly get there. And in a sense, they're the lucky ones. They immediately start seeing the problems. Other people, it takes a little longer, but they still get there. So I would say this, humans have a predisposition toward developing diabetes on the whole, on the mass, and all of us should be taking the precautions to prevent it from happening.
Welcome to Passion Struck. Hi, I'm your host, John R. Miles, and on the show, we decipher the secrets, tips, and guidance of the world's most inspiring people and turn their wisdom into practical advice for you and those around you. Our mission is to help you unlock the power of intentionality so that you can become the best version of yourself. If you're new to the show, I offer advice and answer listener questions on Fridays. We have long-form interviews the rest of the week with guests ranging from astronauts to authors, CEOs, creators, innovators, scientists, military leaders, visionaries, and athletes. Now, let's go out there and become Passion Struck.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 433 of Passion Struck, consistently ranked the number one alternative health podcast. Heartfelt thank you to each and every one of you who return to the show every week, eager to listen, learn, and discover new ways to live better, be better, and make a meaningful impact in the world. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for being here, or you simply want to introduce this to a friend or a family member, and we so appreciate it when you do that. We have episode starter packs, which are collections of our fans' favorite episodes that we put into convenient playlists that give any new listener a great way to get acclimated to everything we do here on the show. Either go to Spotify or passionstruck.com/starterpacks to get started. Are you curious to find out where you stand on the path to becoming Passion Struck? Dive into our engaging Passion Struck quiz, crafted to reflect the core principles shared in my latest book. This quiz offers you a dynamic way to gauge your progress on the Passion Struck continuum. Just head over to passionstruck.com to embark on this insightful journey. With just 20 questions and roughly 10 minutes of your time, don't miss this chance to gain valuable insights into your journey becoming your best self. Take the quiz today. In case you missed them, we had two phenomenal interviews from last week. The first was with Sharon Salzberg, a pioneer in bringing meditation and mindfulness to the Western world. As a New York Times bestselling author and co-founder of one of America's first meditation centers, Sharon shares timeless wisdom, cultivating compassion, resilience, and true happiness. Tune in to discover how Sharon's teachings can transform your life, offering practical tools for dealing with life's challenges and enhancing your emotional well-being. The second was with Dr. Stephen Cabral, a renowned naturopathic doctor and wellness advocate, and we discussed the secrets of holistic health and healing. Dr. Cabral brings a wealth of knowledge from his extensive experience in integrative health, sharing transformative insights into how we can achieve balance in body, mind, and spirit. And if you like those previous episodes or today's, we would so appreciate you giving it a 5-star rating and review. It goes such a long way in strengthening the Passion Struck community where we can help more people create an intentional life. And I know we and our guests love to hear your feedback. Today, we're diving into a crucial and life-altering topic with Eric Edmeads. We're going to unravel the truths behind type 2 diabetes, a condition often seen as a life sentence, but as Eric reveals, it's anything but. In this episode, we're not just talking about managing diabetes, we're exploring a revolutionary shift, potentially reverse it. Eric's new book, Post-Diabetic, co-authored with the esteemed Dr. Ruben Ruiz, is more than just a book. It's a lifeline challenging the status quo and revealing how profit-driven narratives have shaped our understanding of diabetes. Eric's method is a radical departure from the conventional, blending meticulous research with practical, actionable steps to reignite the body's innate health mechanism. The journey that he proposes transitions us from sugar dependency to a state where our bodies thrive on their natural fat-burning capabilities. We'll dissect the innovative behavior change dynamics from the program's backbone, uncover Eric's personal catalyst for targeting diabetes, and dive into the nutritional ethos that could revolutionize our daily eating habits. Eric envisions post-diabetic not just as a pathway to personal health recovery, but as a movement to recalibrate public health narratives and practices. Let's dive into this life-changing dialogue with Eric Edmeads. Thank you for choosing Passion Struck and choosing me to be your host and guide on your journey to creating an intentional life. Now, let that journey begin. Hi, I am so absolutely thrilled and honored to have Eric Edmeades on Passion Struck, someone this audience has wanted me to have for such a long time. Welcome, Eric.
So glad to be here.
Today, we are going to be diving into your brand new book, which has released by the time this episode comes out. It's called Post-Diabetic. And before we get into it, I always like to ask a couple background questions because I think this will lead into our discussion. As I was doing research on you, I understand that your journey into health and wellness actually started with your own personal health struggles when you were a child. Can you shed a little bit more light on the challenges you faced with your health and how they led you to consider dietary changes over tonsil surgery?
Yeah, absolutely. I was born into, I guess, a medical family. My grandfather and two of my uncles were like surgeons. And so we grew up with that. And so when I started having some health difficulties, of course, there was an abundance of advice around, and we went to go and see various doctors and specialists. And I was dealing with things like, of course, I had horrible cystic acne that was cosmetically a pain in the butt, but also painful. I had digestive problems that were so severe that when the cramps would begin, I couldn't even speak. They were unspeakably painful. I had chronic sinus infections and throat infections that were so severe that when a throat specialist looked into my throat, he actually went pale. He's like, "You've been living like that? Like, how much pain are you in?" And a variety of other smaller issues and allergies and things that I was dealing with. And so I'd been to see doctors, and of course, they'd prescribe me pills and inhalants and injections and more pills. And then eventually, one of my doctors recommended a tonsillectomy because somehow the tonsils were at the root of the entire problem and so on. And very lucky for me at that point, a very good friend of mine, a guy named Tim Ames, convinced me to go to a seminar, and nothing I was even interested in doing. And he convinced me to go to a Tony Robbins seminar. And so I went off to this Tony Robbins seminar in Vancouver, Canada, and had a ton of fun. But weirdly, on about the third, fourth day, the last day, Tony started speaking about food and health. And he said some things that just like made sense. And it just made me think a little bit more about food. And so I started doing a bunch of research. And I decided to undertake an experiment. And the experiment was for just 30 days. It wasn't about eating less or anything. I wasn't going on a diet. It was just changing it up a little. I was going to take out some of this and add in some of this. And over the next 30 days, I lost 35 pounds. And all of my infections went away. My acne completely cleared up. I started sleeping through the night for the first time in years and years. And frankly, I looked so different by the end of that 30 days that my mother didn't even recognize me. I flew to go visit her. And when I got off the plane, she didn't see me in the arrivals lounge. She looked right through me. She couldn't see me because I had changed so much. And that really began the journey. But it wasn't it, though. What really began the journey was when my doctor's office called to confirm the throat surgery, and I told him I no longer thought that I needed it. And the conversation that followed that was sickening to me. It was like talking to an unethical used car salesman that was trying to save the sale. It wasn't like a conversation about concern. It wasn't like, "Well, how did you turn it around?" Or it was just basically, "Oh, look, sometimes symptoms go away and they come back and you don't want to end up on the waiting list again. We've booked the surgery. We've already, you know." And so I had to go into the office and I went in for an exam. And bear in mind that my mother couldn't recognize me. So you have to imagine that was visual. And then also the metrics were pretty different, right? The weight, body composition, blood pressure, all those things were different. At no point did anybody in my doctor's office ask me why things were different. Not one of them asked me how I lost 35 pounds. Not one of them asked me why I was in such good health, how my face cleared up, even though I wasn't taking the medication anymore. None of them asked me that. And that I expected to walk in there and have them go, "Wow, what happened?" Nothing. And then I decided to ask questions and I asked my doctor how long he went to medical school. And I think he felt that was a bit, I was 21 years old and I looked about 15. And I think he thought it was an impetuous question, and he said 6 years. And I said, "In the 6 years, how much of that time did you spend studying nutrition?" And I got an answer that these days people probably pretty much know, but man, I'll tell you, 25 years ago, nobody knew this. None, literally none. There was no required study of nutrition in 6 years of medical school. And that thought jarred me no less than if I was on a plane and found out that the pilot hadn't studied landings.
Yeah, it is so interesting. And I had the opportunity to interview Mark Hyman, a mutual friend of ours, for the second time a few months ago. And for those who are listening, he actually wrote a foreword for this most recent book that we're going to discuss. But Mark and I were having this discussion because his daughter is currently going through medical school. And what's amazing to me is they're still not teaching it, which after all the things that have been said about it and the importance of the gut-mind connection and how it influences really everything about you, I would have thought that there would have been some drastic changes into the curriculums.
I would have thought so too. The only country that I have found, and I've been to 60 some odd countries and I've looked into this and asked all over, the only country I found that has a prerequisite requirement of nutrition study for a medical degree is Albania. And I will say, and I can't name the country at this point, but we have been approached by a substantial university in Asia to create a 6-month evolutionary biology nutrition program that they want to make as a requisite part of the medical school program they have there. So the change is coming, but first of all, it shouldn't have been that way in the first place. And secondly, the change is coming way too slowly.
I appreciate you sharing all this. And I think another fascinating thing about your background and something that you've written and talked a lot about is your time with Bushmen. And I think that the lifestyle that I've heard you talk about that they live and the Western diet that we're now eating, it's such a fascinating gap. What, based on your observations, what are some of the most critical dietary lessons that modern society can take from hunter-gatherer cultures?
I think the first really important lesson is that the word diet has been hijacked. When we speak of humans, the word diet means temporary alteration to your day-to-day eating pattern in order to achieve a short-term goal, like fitting into a special outfit for a particular occasion. That's what it means. It means making a temporary change to achieve a short-term outcome. But in all other respects, the word diet means something else, like literally in all other respects. If you're talking about an elephant walking in the savannah, and you ask anybody what the elephant's diet is, they'll say, well, the elephant's diet consists of eating about 200 kilograms of grass, bark, and seasonally available fruits on a day-by-day basis, including drinking 70 liters of water and walking, you know, something like 20 miles a day. And that's the elephant's diet. It's way of life. And then if you say, but what about the cheetah over there? What's its diet? Oh, its diet is to eat 2.5 kilograms of fresh meat pretty much on a daily basis. They don't like meat that was already sitting there. Like the hyenas will eat that. They want the fresh meat. That's their diet. And then of course we could go to the hyena. What's their diet? Well, their diet consists of everything from fresh meat to sinew to bones and marrow because they're specialist bone crushers and so on. Diet means way of life for every other species on earth. The only people that go on diets, the only species that go on diets are humans and pets. And we happen to be the sickest species on the planet. And so that's the first distinction, is that there is in fact a human diet. And that's a difficult pill for some people to swallow, because they all want to have this conversation that, what about if having my genome test, or I've had my gut bacteria checked and it says, and all that kind of stuff. And those messages, oh, my blood type is different than his blood type. And those messages are interesting, and they definitely appeal to the ego. Everybody wants the diet that's their diet. If you walked into a bookstore and you saw your name on the cover and it said, it's your diet, you're like, I better buy that. But the truth of it is that we have such little genetic spread between us. We all require the same vitamins, the same minerals, the same amino acids, the same fatty acids, the same water. We have the same exact requirements, and we have the same exact food processing capabilities. Actually, as a recent thing that I just saw in the news, is that there's been a recent discovery that the largest anaconda in the world is a breakaway subspecies of another species of anaconda. And this just came out in the last couple of weeks. So there's the northern anaconda and the southern anaconda, and the northern one is a little bigger than the southern one. And there's a 5% genetic spread between them, which allows them to be considered separate species. But their diets, how different are they? They're not. With a 5% genetic difference, they basically eat exactly the same things. There are some subtle differences, mostly about size, but that's it. Well, we have about 2% genetic difference from chimpanzees, let alone each other. And so that's one of the big things, that when you go and you watch hunter-gatherers and you look at the way they eat, they clearly are following an instinctual pattern that has been ingrained in over a multi-million year process that happens weirdly to coincide with what we know from the archaeological record. So that's a big distinction, that we do know what the diet is. We don't need to be confused that one day eggs cause diabetes and the next day they help diabetes, and then meat is good and meat is bad and bread is good and bread is bad. All of that confusion is being caused by two different things. One is somewhat innocent, and that's food industry giants competing for their share of our plates. And the other one is a little more insidious, and that is the intentional insemination of cognitive dissonance so that people just are confused and give up and eat a donut.
I think it's so interesting how much changed following World War II. I have an interesting story because my grandfather was part of this change. I don't think I've ever talked about this publicly, and I didn't know about it because he had a 50-year vow of silence. But he was in the 11th Airborne getting ready to deploy to Asia during World War II, and about 2 weeks before the deployment, he gets called into his commanding officer's office and says, "What am I here for?" And he goes, "Unfortunately, son, you're not going to the war. Secretary of War has given you orders to Fort Detrick." He has no idea what's going on. Goes to Fort Detrick, Maryland, gets inoculations and medical tests for about 3 weeks. After about 3 weeks, he goes to base and is met by his college chemistry professor, University of Michigan, who tells him that he has been recruited into germ and biological warfare. So he spends a number of years doing this. And once he gets out of the military, he gets recruited by Kraft Food. And for the next 40 years, he goes on to become the head of research and development and is one of the leading scientists and pharmacologists who develops many of the ingredients to preserve the shelf life of food. And it's just an interesting coincidence because you would think a person who's experienced in biological warfare, how in the world would they transition to Kraft? But if you think about what they were looking for at that time, they were looking for pharmacists, chemistry majors, others who could understand how do you elongate shelf life. I don't think he ever, knowing how sincere he was, I don't think he ever realized the implications of some of the discoveries that he was doing. Do you think that we have gone from that standpoint where a lot of these people didn't really understand the implications to now they know it and they're still knowingly trying to hide this from us or deceive us?
Generally speaking, I think capitalism is the best system that we've developed so far for the exchange of value in our culture. The other systems have failed much more quickly and much more famously than capitalism, but capitalism clearly has some pretty significant problems. I can give you any number of statistics that would make you angry enough to want to go and punch somebody. I could tell you that diabetes is going to cost America $400 billion this year. And when you compare a billion to a million, you can spend $1 million by spending $80,000 a month for a year. To spend $1 billion, you have to do that for 1,000 years. $400 billion is a lot of money. Obamacare saves the government apparently about $10 billion a year. Diabetes is costing the country $400 billion a year. And that $400 billion doesn't even compare to the personal suffering that it's causing. The earlier you are when you get diabetes, the more likely it is you're going to lose your eyesight, you lose your arms to amputation, develop heart disease, cancer. You're going to devastate entire families. And we're at a stage now where, what is it now? 7 out of 10 people in America are on the diabetic spectrum. It's a frightening idea. And we should be very angry about it because it's an optional disease that nobody has to have. And it's nobody's fault. Now we enter into this problem. It's somebody's fault. It's the food industry's fault. So I want to go punch somebody. I'm really angry about that. I want to go punish them. I want to key their car or something. But then who is that exactly? Is it the marketing guy? Because he's just doing his job. And well, so maybe it's like the CEO. Well, she's just doing her job and just answering to the board. So maybe it's the chairman of the board that I should go and assault or I should have words with or be angry with. And then you realize, well, the chairman of the board really answers to the shareholders. Well, who are the shareholders? Our parents' pension funds. So it's not like there's this one particularly evil person that's trying to give everybody obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart disease. And it's a broken system, a system wherein you have a profit-seeking food industry, which means they want to drive costs down. Well, you drive costs down by removing nutrition from the food, and then you want to increase sales. So how do you do that? Well, by making your food nutritionally empty so people eat more of it. And while you're at it, why not make it emotionally and physically addictive so people lose control? You're going to do that. That's going to be the result of that. The ask is to increase profitability for food manufacturing. The delivery is make people eat more. That's just how it is. And then on the other side, you're dealing with the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry does not benefit from being healthy at all. Recently, the FDA approved a new eye drop for people who develop the after 45 or so years old, and you give in to the need for the reading glasses. Well, apparently they've approved an eye drop that you take every day, and it softens up the little lens and allows you to operate your day without your reading glasses. But you have to take the drop every day, and it's expensive because I can't help but wonder how much of their research budget went into making it a daily drop instead of a monthly one or a single one. So I don't think there's any one particularly evil person. There's a broken system. And that system is an absolute disaster for us. I said something earlier, and I really want to underscore this point. If anybody listening right now is overweight or type 2 diabetic, or they have a quote lifestyle disease, I want you to know that it's not your fault. It is absolutely not your fault. I don't care that you could have eaten a little less, you could have moved a little more. That's what they want to tell you. They want to tell you, oh, if you just moved a little more and ate a little less, you wouldn't have this problem. You have a lifestyle disease. The reason it's called a lifestyle disease, in my opinion, is that The tobacco companies realized back in the 70s and 80s that they were about to start facing serious product liability suits from people. They were in trouble. They knew that they had been causing serious lung cancer, emphysema, and other diseases. And frankly, there are two ways that you can tamper with a jury. The one way you can tamper with a jury is against the law. And that's where you find out where the jury lives and you go and bribe them or extort from them or muscle them in some way. That's generally frowned upon behavior. But the other way that you can tamper with a jury is to tamper with the general population and change their mindset so that they will be on your side in case they're on the jury. And so how do you do that? You start introducing the term Lyme disease related to lung cancer. You start making people become guilty for the development of their, well, clearly they shouldn't have been smoking. They are idiots. No, let's remember that 3 out of 4 doctors recommend smoking. Remember, one of the ways to manage your weight during your pregnancy is to have a cigarette. Remember, ladies, you've come a long way, baby. They were manipulated into this. And of course, what's the net effect of that? They ended up getting emphysema, lung cancer, dying, and so on. But if we can get the whole population to believe it's a lifestyle disease, then when those people find their way on a jury, they're going to shift the blame to the consumer. And this was a very effective approach, and it worked very well until the population began to realize how deceptive and deceitful this tobacco industry had been. Then you started seeing the multi-million dollar awards being given to families that lost people to these diseases. But here's the deal. What did tobacco do when they realized how much trouble they're in? They started buying food companies. And so that same concept is going on right now. Type 2 diabetes is a lifestyle disease. No, it isn't. It is a disease that is a result of a disgusting, disastrous, and unethical food manufacturing system. That's it. And of course, if we can call it a lifestyle disease, then it's your fault. It's not your fault. Sad part is, it is your responsibility.
Well, the sad part to me is not only is diabetes increasing, basically all forms of cancer are increasing, ALS is increasing, Alzheimer's is increasing. You just start looking at this and the culprits really come down to a couple of things that we're going to explore, sugar and the manufactured food that we're eating. I was just on Instagram a couple of days ago, and I saw this reel that I couldn't believe it was real until I did some research on it. They were basically showing people walking down the street of New York City in 1934, and there were hundreds of them coming by the camera. I'm not sure if you've seen this. It had a caption, "Where are the overweight or where are the obese people?" And as these people are going by, there weren't any. It was amazing, like hundreds and hundreds of people walking by. But as you have talked a lot about in the past, so many of the things that our biology, the way that we were wired to be hunter-gatherers, has disappeared from our lives. Yeah. And I end up walking between 5 to 10 miles per day. And people ask me, why do you walk so much? Because it's one of the healthiest things that you can do for your body, is my answer. But today we're going to be talking a lot about behavior change and the power of choice, which is something that we love to talk about on this show. And in the book, you've introduced really a groundbreaking concept. You refer to individuals who have reversed their diabetic condition as post-diabetic, where traditional medical terminology labels them as pre-diabetic. Can you delve into why this term more accurately reflects the journey?
Absolutely. In fact, maybe the best way to say that is I was having a conversation with Mark Hyman some years ago, and I was talking to him about that when we developed our first behavior change programs around food, we didn't do it for weight loss and we didn't do it for diabetes. We just did it for improved relationship with food. But yet we were facing, no kidding, weekly letters from people telling us that they'd reverse their diabetes. But what bothered me about it, and I was explaining this to him on an interview we were doing, that their doctor was saying, oh, you were type 2 diabetic at your last check-in, but now you're pre-diabetic. And I'm very sensitive to language patterns and the almost hypnotic nature of language. For example, we know if you tell a child, don't spill the milk when they're walking across they're going to spill it. Right? Don't spill the milk. You have to picture the thing not to do it. So you say, don't spill the milk. You're basically saying spill the milk. So language patterns are very important. And it irritated me that my clients had done all this great work and reversed the condition such that they were no longer in the diabetic range. And now their doctor was calling them pre-diabetic. Well, what does pre mean? Pre means before. Pre indicates a direction. Pre means you're still going to go there. And I didn't like that at all. The other reason I didn't like it is that I believe that the entire condition of prediabetes was basically created to expand the prescription window. And let me explain what I mean is that you can imagine a bunch of pharmaceutical executives sitting here going, well, shoot, we've sold all the drugs we can. All the diabetics are taking them. What are we going to do now? We got to find more diabetics. Well, there are some undiagnosed. We can set up kiosks in the mall and we can try and find them and then we can prescribe drugs to them. Yeah, but why don't we just change the A1C level down a little? And if we just move it down like one percentage point, we'll pick up millions of them. Nah, that would be too that would be too obvious. They'd see that. What we can do is create a new classification that happens before diabetes. We'll call it pre-diabetic. We'll make it a medical condition, and that will give doctors the freedom to prescribe while they're in that window, which they currently don't have. I really genuinely believe that something along those lines happened to create this idea of pre-diabetic. And now our clients are moving away from diabetes and they're still in the prescription window. And since their doctors were trained on, by and large, they were trained on the management of diabetes, not the reversal of it. So what are they going to do? They're going to go and give them drugs. And so I said to Mark, I think we should be calling it post-diabetic. For a time when you reverse your type 2 diabetes, you might have metrics similar to those of a pre-diabetic, but you are trending in the other direction. And therefore, your medical advice should be distinctly different from somebody with the same metrics. And so we call that post-diabetic. And even once they've moved out of the pre-diabetic range, they still remain post-diabetic. Why? Because they've demonstrated a proclivity for developing diabetes. And that means that they need to be a little bit more on point with their lifestyle decisions and a little bit more on point with their understanding of the food industry to make sure that they don't regress and go back to the diabetic condition they were before they became post-diabetic.
Yeah, it's interesting, Eric. My fiance is a primary care provider, and she tells me that one of the things that happens with the medical system now and the way we're run by protocols is once a patient is diagnosed with diabetes, it's permanently then embedded. So now every time they go to the doctor wants that extra revenue because they're being paid to do extra tests, extra things. So it brings them in more money. So we have this loop in the system that just permeates this terrible recording of what this is and doesn't answer or doesn't look at the fact that it can be reversed.
My co-author, as you mentioned, Mark Hyman wrote the foreword, and my co-author is a very interesting man. His name is Ruben Ruiz, medical doctor, assistant professor. He used to be an assistant professor of medicine at UCLA. He was an internist for many years, and now he runs three medical clinics in Southern California. And at one stage, a few years ago, he was 40 pounds overweight, type 2 diabetic, hypertensive, and on 10 prescription medications. 10 prescription medications. Reading the side effects from one prescription medication is impossible. Imagining the conflicts and side effects involved in 10 prescription medications is diabolical at the minimum. And he was obviously always tired all the time. And so he stopped off at Starbucks to get himself a venti so he could stay awake while he drove to the clinic. And as he's drinking the coffee, he puts it in the cup holder and he's driving along and he drifts off to sleep and he ends up in an accident. And it's like bad. A couple of days later, he's in a rental car because luckily nobody was hurt, including him. And now he's in a rental car driving back off to the clinic again, stops off at the same drive-through, picks up another coffee because he can't stay awake, falls asleep again in traffic, gets into another wreck. And he gets home at the end of that day. Again, luckily nobody hurt, but he was hurt. And what I mean by that is that his sense of self-identity was hurt. He started asking a very valid, important question. What right did he have to be a doctor if he can't even heal thyself? And so he was really having a crisis of conscience. Like, how can I go to my clinic every day and give people advice when I'm sick, when I'm sitting here like this? And so weirdly, he finds his way off to the internet and he ends up doing one of our programs that are now the sort of crux of the program development at Diabetes Reversal Institute. And he went through this program. And after 90 days, he'd lost 40 pounds. He was no longer type 2 diabetic. He wasn't even pre-diabetic. He was fully post-diabetic. He was also no longer hypertensive and he was off 9 of his prescription medications. It took a few more months to get off the 10th one. And then he contacted me and this is what he said. We have to get this message out into the world because nobody told me in medical school as a student or as a teacher that this was a reversible condition. I was taught that it was chronic. I was told it needed to be managed and I was given the list of drugs to manage it with.
Well, I love that you just answered that because that's exactly where I was going to go with the question anyhow. Before we go a little bit further into type 2 diabetes, I think it's important if the audience doesn't understand the difference, can you give an explanation of how type 2 diabetes differs from type 1? And there are more variations than that, but those are the two that most know.
Type 1 diabetes is what you might call the original diabetes. And it's, I don't even know that we're all that clear exactly what the cause is. It appears to be maybe an autoimmune condition. And once you have it, the current understanding is that it's not reversible. We have not seen any case. We've seen one case that somebody was classified as type 1 and they clocked a reversal, but I'm pretty sure they were just misclassified. We've not seen any cases of credible reversible of type 1. We've seen dramatic improvement. We've seen people cut their insulin by half or 70%, but not be able to reverse the condition. Type 1 is also referred to as insulin dependent, as in you're not producing insulin and you need exogenous insulin. And that accounts for about 5% of diabetes around the world. Type 2 is, we might want to call it, say, acquired diabetes. It's, and as we put in the book, and as Mark underscores in the foreword, is that Ruben and my approach to diabetes was to say, let's not treat it like a disease. Let's treat it like a repetitive stress disorder, that your body was taken out of balance because of violating evolutionary principles. And that if you return the body back to balance, you can reverse the condition. And in the vast majority of cases, you can reverse the condition, especially if you reverse the condition before any permanent damage is done. For example, once diabetes has taken your eyesight, not much we can do about that. We can still potentially reverse the diabetes, but not necessarily the damage. And then I would suggest, and I've been saying this for 10 years, and I'm starting to see it appear in different places, but there's a type 3 diabetes. And this is really what we're talking about here is dementia. It's, say, insulin resistance in the brain. And this is a very scary thing. And I want to suggest to you strongly that you get Dr. David Perlmutter on your podcast if you haven't had a chance. He's the author of Grain, Brain, and Drop Acid. Phenomenal guy. And one of the things he'll be there to tell you is that if you make it now to, say, 75 years old, you have a 50% chance of losing yourself to dementia. And we know that's also as a result of being taken out of balance. It doesn't have to be that way.
No, and it doesn't. And I think one of the things from what I have researched and had guests tell me is that one of the big issues that people are facing is we're not sleeping as well. And when you're not sleeping as well, you're not getting rid of the plaques and clearing them out. And so you get this buildup, which then over time leads to dementia and other things happening. And I know from studying you that you do not drink. I have given up drinking. And it's amazing how much sleep improves when that isn't part of your lifestyle and how much deeper sleep you get as well. So, Eric, I wanted to pivot here for just a second. How much do you think type 2 diabetes is based on hereditary factors based on your research, as opposed to something that all of us are equally exposed to?
I'll answer that, but I want to say this about things that are hereditary. In my very layman's way of describing this, when we think of something being hereditary, there's two approaches to take. One is a deterministic approach, and the other one is a risk factor approach. Without getting into naming names here, we all know the story of a major celebrity who turned out to have the genetic predisposition for a variety of the female cancers that might come with that genetic predisposition. And her decision at that point was to remove all of those feminine parts, ovaries and mammary glands and uterus and so on. What I would suggest is that that's why I don't like that type of science, because her having that particular gene marker doesn't mean she will get the disease. It means she's higher risk for it. And when we say higher risk for it, what we mean is higher risk for it in our modern world, in our modern lifestyle. That means there are other precautions that could have been taken and avoided rather than undertaking an incredibly dangerous and invasive surgery. Now, so we can say the same thing here with diabetes, is that if there's diabetes in your family, it doesn't mean you're going to get diabetes. It means you need to be more careful than the average person. So that's what it really means. And remember also that it's not simply a genetic determination. It's a epigenetic and social determination. In other words, if your parents were diabetic, your odds of becoming diabetic type 2 as well are much, much higher, because maybe their genetic proclivity or their epigenetic expression and the epigenetic expression they birthed you with, and then your social conditioning from them through your years of growing up, which then influenced your own epigenetic expression, and then your lifestyle. And all of those things mean that not only is it, quote, hereditary, but it's an accelerated hereditary pattern. In other words, your parents didn't get diabetes until they were 40, but you're getting it at 20. because these things all stack and combine on each other. I can tell you just 2 days ago, I'm having a conversation with a client of ours that was type 2 diabetic and had completely reversed it, full post-diabetic. And everyone in their family is diabetic. And they said, well, you can't do that. We all have diabetes. And my client's response was, well, hold on. Maybe reversing it is hereditary too. Let's just all reverse it together. And so what I would say is if somebody believes that they have a genetic predisposition, that just means they need to be more cautious about it. But I'll point this out. Diabetes is a condition that in the 70s, it took 30 years to create it. Basically, nobody under 40 had type 2 diabetes in the 70s. It was like the video you're talking about. Same thing. If you look at a photograph of people on Santa Monica Pier in 1972, nobody on there has a belly. Like that's just how it was back then. So in that lifestyle, in that version of the food industry, you couldn't really get diabetes until you're over 40. Now we have teens and preteens and young people that are pre-diabetic and full-blown diabetic. So it's accelerating. And then we have to remember something else about that. The longer you have type 2 diabetes, the more damage it creates in your body. And so instead of getting it at 40 and losing your eyesight at 65, you're going to get it at 20 and what? Lose your eyesight at 43? It's a very dangerous thing. And so I'm going to say this. Everybody has a genetic predisposition for type 2 diabetes. And the reason everybody has this is that everybody evolved the ability to manage sugar differently in the autumn in order to prepare them for the winter. Everybody, all humans develop this. Now, some of us have it stronger than others, of course, but every single one of us behaves the same way if we eat too much sugar too consistently for too long a time. We slow our metabolisms down. We increase our cravings for sugar. We start storing excessive amounts of sugar. Our cells start refusing to accept the sugar in insulin sensitivity problems. And we start storing fat. Like pretty much everybody goes through that cycle. The question is, how far can you push it? Some people can't push it that far and they instantly get there. And in a sense, they're the lucky ones. They immediately start seeing the problems. Other people, it takes a little longer, but they still get there. So I would say this, humans have a predisposition toward developing diabetes on the whole, on the mass, and all of us should be taking the precautions to prevent it from happening.
And this is where I wanted to go next, because in the book, you have the concept of shifting the blame in society's growing sugar addiction. And you have a statistic in here that ironically, the first time I heard it, I was actually watching a speech that President Bill Clinton gave. And he was asked, what do you think the biggest threat is facing humanity or something like that? And he said that it's because the sugar consumption is now exceeding 150 pounds per person. And I remember hearing that and I was like, wow, mind blow. 150 pounds.
We have the same story. I was sitting talking with a friend of mine because I was doing a bunch of research and I stumbled upon two statistics. That one that you've just said, it was 154 pounds in that particular study. And another statistic that indicated that being obese, which is to say carrying, say, more than 30 pounds surplus, roughly speaking, depending on your height and what have you, being obese was seven times more dangerous to longevity than smoking a pack of cigarettes every day. I was like, I read those two things and I thought, that's outstanding. That can't be right. If that was true, it'd be on the cover of CNN. If CNN wasn't sponsored by pharmaceutical industries and food companies, maybe. But what was crazy is, no kidding, you mentioned Bill Clinton. No kidding. I went off to London and I was doing two events in 2 days. One day I had to follow Bill Clinton on stage. The next day I had to follow Tony Robbins. Quite a daunting task in both cases. And I'm sitting in the audience getting ready to go on stage after Bill Clinton. And he's doing a cue and a woman in the audience, just like you just described, says, Mr. President, what do you believe to be the greatest threats facing humanity today? And he said exactly what you just said. He said, well, the average American has gone to eating 154 pounds of sugar a year, and I think that's going to be devastating, especially when you add to that obesity is seven times more dangerous than smoking a pack of cigarettes every day. And I'm sitting there going, holy crap. And the person that I told this to a few months before didn't believe me when I told her, didn't believe me. But now Bill said it, she believed.
Well, that's just how things go, isn't it? I could say things 100 times and no one believes me. Mark Hyman says it one time and it goes viral. I don't care who said it. It's just important that the message gets out there.
Yeah.
So it's so interesting how sugar is now leading to health conditions, everything from dental cavities, coronary heart disease, cholesterol buildup. And the book had another really interesting point, and that was this phenomenon that increased consumption leads to a dulled taste perception, requiring even more sugar to satisfy the craving. And so we have this never-ending cycle of overconsumption and addiction that's now happening.
Yeah, if I can back up away from that and come back to it, what I mean is this, is that what we know doesn't work is telling somebody, oh, you're now type 2 diabetic, so here's a few lifestyle modifications you might attempt that might help you to manage the disease and keep it under control. We know that doesn't work. We know that client is depressed with the news they just got, and the first thing they do is drive to Krispy Kreme. We know that rule-based dieting doesn't work at all. So one of the things that we had to figure out is, how can we get people to integrate these changes into their life in a really functional way? And one of the first things that we had to do that was to understand the evolutionary underpinnings of the flawed behavior in the first place. Now, that goes to your question. I want you to imagine that you and I are walking along in sub-Saharan Africa in the autumn. And we're walking along and we stumble upon a sour plum tree. Now, I happen to know this tree. They're beautiful plums. They're about the size of a large green grape, and they have a thick, leathery skin. And you squeeze them real hard and they pop the fruit into your mouth, and the fruit hits your mouth, and it's like more sour than any sour candy, but in a nice way. And then as the sourness fades, it becomes this gorgeous, sweet, fruity flavor. But there are a few things to know about this. It's 70 to 80% pit and only a little light layer of flesh around the outside. So I'm not getting that much sugar. So I'm going to eat one of those. Then I'm going to eat another one. You're going to eat a few. Now that we've eaten a few, what's happening inside our body? Well, our pancreas is reacting to this sugar we've taken in, and it's saying, well, we got to manage the sugar down because excessive sugar is toxic, right? We don't want to die from the excess sugar. So the pancreas sends out insulin and says, hey, you got to let this sugar into the cells so we can burn this energy and burn this energy. And if the cells get full, hell, we'll start storing it as glycogen if we get that much, but we got to produce insulin. Now, as you produce the insulin, your blood sugar begins to crash quite rapidly, which stimulates a craving for you to eat another berry. And this seems like a flaw. In today's world, it definitely seems like God or evolution or Darwin or somebody messed this up. Like, what a ridiculous system that is. We eat sugar and we want to eat more sugar. That's ridiculous. Only for 99.99% of our history, it was a literally life-saving craving. Because imagine for a minute, I don't have that craving. I eat three pieces of fruit and I go, I'm done. But you're like, no, I got to get some more. And you gorge yourself on them. You gorge yourself on you eat it. And by the way, the stomach we know is very transformable. Normally it's about the size of your fist, but if you're binging, you can expand your stomach out to a massive size. It's expandable. So you eat so much fruit that your belly is distended. You're the gluttonous one. I'm the proud, self-controlled one. Only here's what's going on. In your biochemistry, you're starting to store glycogen and you're starting to store fat. And every day that you do this, you're going to store just a little bit more fat. And I'm not. And then the winter is going to come and I'm going to be dead and pass on no genes. You are going to survive that winter and pass on your very good fat-saving genes. So when you begin to understand that this is a perfect evolutionary design for a Paleolithic lifestyle, then you can then decode it and look at it in our modern lifestyle. And then you take a look and go, oh, when I eat carbs, I'm going to crave carbs. That one piece of information is incredibly freeing to a lot of people because they begin to realize now why the food industry puts sugar in things where it has no business being, because it makes you buy more.
Well, it absolutely does. And for the listener who's tuning into this episode, a couple of weeks prior to this one launching, I had Dr. Casey Means on the show, and we did a ton of deep dives into blood sugar levels, insulin dependency, et cetera. But Eric, I did want to talk to you a little bit about this. Why is it so crucial to maintain stable blood sugar levels, and what potential risks do people face when they have constant or chronic fluctuations in their blood sugar?
All right. This is a great question, and I'm going to break it into the two parts that you're asking. Why is it so important that people maintain consistent blood sugar levels without spikes? It isn't. It is not. That is not important. And I know this goes in the face of the FDA just approved constant glucose monitors so people can buy their own. They don't even need a prescription anymore and they can go and measure their glucose and so on. The second part of your question is why they should do that, why they should avoid spiking their blood sugar on a continuing consistent basis. That they should avoid. So let's just take a step back for a minute. If we imagine that we put a constant glucose monitor on a Hadzabe Bushman or on any prehistoric human being, would they have spiked their blood sugar? Yes, for certain, they would have spiked their blood sugar. They wouldn't have walked around and go, ooh, I don't want to spike my blood sugar. when they saw the fruit on the tree, they would have eaten as much of it as they could and spiked their blood sugar. And then when they stumbled upon it, like just a few weeks ago, I was with the Hadzabe people and we were, you know, out hunting and we suddenly stumbled upon a beehive deep in the ground. And we dug down deep, deep into this beehive. And I took my phone and with the camera and I went, it's so beautiful to see what it looked like inside there. And they're scooping the honey out and they're eating as much of it as they can get. Do you think they spiked their blood sugar? Of course they did. The issue is not to avoid blood sugar spikes. It's to avoid doing them too often or to avoid doing them regularly. It's not that you have to maintain this perfectly calm blood sugar. It's that you want low blood sugar most of the time with occasional spikes seasonally. And so that's why I'm not really that big a fan. I think glucose monitors are curious and interesting, but every now and again, I bump into somebody and go, oh, I can't have that. It spikes my blood sugar. Hold on a second now. What season are you trying to mimic right now? Are you trying to mimic a season of autumn where blood sugar spiking is actually a normal and functional part of the human metabolism? Then you don't need to know that. It's still neat to wear the glucose monitor and see it spike, but you shouldn't be afraid of that spike. And in the same way, we've made people, particularly women all over the planet, afraid of their bathroom scales. We're now making people afraid of their blood sugar spikes. They should be aware of them. But to pretend that humans aren't supposed to have them, I think is a baby bathwater problem, very typical to what happens in the diet industry on the whole.
Okay. Well, thank you for that perspective because it's counter to a couple of the recent guests that I've come on. But then again, they are people who are founders of companies who have these devices. So I could see why they're telling a...
I imagine that if they and I were to sit and have a talk about it, I don't think they would disagree with me. But what they would argue is that the average person has those blood sugar spikes so regularly that it's better that they have them none at all. And what I would say is that's true. That actually is true. What I'm saying is I want to support people in creating as close to a human experience as they can, which means that when, like we live here in the Dominican Republic, I can tell you right now, I haven't had any kind of fruit in the longest time. I'm just not in that season at the moment. But I can tell you, as soon as those mangoes kick in, or if the cacao season, I think I just missed the cacao season, but cacao fruits, when they are here, I'm eating them and I'm going to spike my blood sugar. And you know what? My body's going to go, thank you, because I don't do it every day and I don't even do it every week and I don't even do it every month.
Eric, time is going so quickly, and I had wanted to talk to you about the evolution gap, which is the topic of your first book that you talk about in this book, but I'm going to let the listener dive more into that by buying your book. I wanted to get, for the time we have left, to the second part of your book, which is your 9-week plan for reversing diabetes. And your approach to managing diabetes and overall health is really based on intentional behavior change, and it's emphasizing gradual improvement rather than drastic changes, which is something that I talk about all the time. Could you elaborate on how your book guides individuals through making those incremental adjustments in both psychology and nutrition?
Many years ago, I made the decision. Well, I'll say this. I left high school wanting to be a teacher, and then I found out how poorly we treat teachers economically and in other ways, and I decided not to become a teacher. About 12 or 13 years ago, I got a call from Tony Robbins' company asking if I would come and teach business at his business seminars. And I was like blown away. And I went off and I toured with Tony for about a year. And he was so good to me, treated me really well. And he reminded me how I wanted to be a teacher. In the end, I decided that I would like divest myself from my normal business world and become a teacher. But I did some market research. And one of the things I found out in the market research is that when you run people through an intensive seminar retreat or educational program, only about 6% of the people actually learn and integrate the knowledge into their lives. And that, to me, was devastatingly bad news. I was not interested in devoting my time to this if only 6% of the people were going to get somewhere. So my next sort of area of research was in behavioral psychology to truly understand what created habits and what created behavioral change and shift and so on. And so I developed a transformative education system called Behavioral Change Dynamics. It's a series of filters and logical structures for the way you design events, whether it's a digital program or a book or a retreat, that there's a very specific structure that people go through that builds their self-esteem as they go through the process, rather than, say, for example, the diet industry, which if you were an alien from another planet and you looked at the average diet, you would have to assume that the purpose of that diet was to destroy people's self-esteem and totally destroy their confidence, which is why they fail. In our business training programs, we tested this behavioral change dynamics and we got phenomenal results. There came a point in time when a lot of people were asking me for dietary help just because of the changes I'd made in my life and so on. And I was frustrated because I would give them, I'd write it on a piece of paper, eat all this and don't eat that and move like this. And they would do it for a week or two, but they'd give up eventually. And I was like, And I realized we've done this for business. Why don't we do it for health? So we designed our first Wild Fit challenge. as a 90-day, week-by-week incremental adjustment program for lifestyle adjustment. It's not a diet. In fact, what our clients will tell you is once they've done that, they will never go on a diet ever again because they won't need to. And that's consistent. So I developed this, and here's some metrics. The completion rate of video training programs on most platforms runs between 3 and 6%. That's the completion rate. So when people buy a program like that, they don't tend to finish them. We have an 85% completion rate for a three-month program on nutrition. It's very unlikely. We've been the audience choice. We've won the audience choice award with our publisher. Every year they've offered that award. We've done something different. And so in the book, there's two great things about the book. The book does guide you through a very carefully constructed and proven, we have clinical trials, by the way, starting in the next week or so, but a proven system of incremental psychological and physiological changes that you go through over a 9-week period that will move you toward post-diabetes. And in the first edition of the book, which is what's coming out on March 26th, the book comes with a free place in one of our digital training programs, which is normally, I think, $300 or $400. So the book comes with that. So you could read it in the book if you want, or you can just go online and register yourself in for a free place and actually go through the video coaching program that will guide you through it. The video coaching program is a little bit longer. It's 13 weeks, but it's basically the same structure and it is very effective.
Thanks for going through that. And one other thing I wanted to touch on with the time we have left is in the book, you introduced the concept of food angel and food devil. And it caught my interest because last night I was at a Toastmasters meeting and one of the speakers was talking about our inner voice. And these two are really the representations of our internal dialogue about food choices. Why is it so important that we recognize and understand the dynamic between these two? And how can it empower people to make better eating decisions?
Human beings evolved the ability to eat unconsciously. Or subconsciously. In other words, if you consider how dangerous nature used to be, and it was dangerous, there were cats that hunted us, other tribes, weather, elephants, it was dangerous out there. And so we developed the ability to eat and look around and not necessarily focus upon what we're eating. And that was a very important component of our evolutionary upbringing, that we developed that capability to be able to not focus on what we're eating and to be able to focus on the environment. Now, the trouble with that today is that the average person can go to a movie and eat a large popcorn before the movie's even started and barely even remember the experience. We can do this automatic eating thing. And so very many times we make decisions that way. We're driving along and suddenly we find the car moving into the drive-thru and we didn't even decide to do it. Or we're buying some dysfunctional food, or we're at home and we get bored with what we're doing. We walk to the fridge and we just start eating and we're not even paying attention to it. By opening people's consciousness to the multiple personality disorder that most people have about food, and trust me, they do. And anybody who doubts that, look, if you've ever walked into a room, say at the office, and somebody goes, oh, look, you see some donuts over there, and a voice pops into your head and says, oh, look, Jimmy brought in donuts again. And then another voice goes, come on now, let's take it easy with the donuts. And the other voice goes, come on, we could just have one. That multiple personality disorder about food is killing America and the world. It's terrible. People are giving into it all the time. Everything in moderation is the ultimate clincher of the food devil. Oh, come on. You deserve a break today. You've worked so hard. You've been so good on your diet. Come on, just one won't hurt. We've all heard those kinds of comments inside our head. By empowering our clients to become very conscious of that dialogue, we create something we call a Frankl moment. And this is borrowed from Viktor Frankl, who reminded us that the last ultimate freedom is the freedom to make your own meanings up, to make your own decisions about how you respond in a given situation. The trouble is, it's very hard to have that moment of consciousness if you are unconsciously eating. If I can help you to see that, if I can help you to notice those voices, and anybody who's listening, this week, do this exercise. Every time you see a food that you know is not ideal, doesn't mean you're not going to eat it. It's not perfect. Notice the conversation. How do you talk yourself into it? You've got a strategy that you use for talking yourself into it. And it might be, like I said, you might have the drug dealer version, which is, come on, just one wouldn't hurt. Or you might have the miser. The miser goes like this. Yeah, but Freddie brought them in and they're free. Nobody can turn down free food. Or you might have the empath. And the empath says, but they made it with love. There's all these little voices that are like guiding you. And the minute you recognize them, they begin to lose their power. So here's my little challenge for you. If this week you hear a little voice saying that to you, everything in moderation, or just one, or you deserve it, then pop me a note on Instagram and tell me that you spotted the food devil. Because once you've seen that, then you have just opened up a moment of consciousness and you've made a very powerful step toward what we call food freedom. And that is where the food industry is no longer in charge of feeding you.
Eric, we've covered a lot today. There was so much more I wanted to cover. We probably could have talked for 2 or 3 hours, but I think we've given the audience a great teaser. Can you tell them where they can find you? Do you have any free gifts that you'd like to offer them, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the first thing is I manage my own Instagram. So if you want to have a chat, you want to talk to me, I do my best to answer everybody I can. You can find me at my name, at Eric Edmeans. If you want to make a dramatic improvement in your relationship with food, if you've got an autoimmune condition or inflammation or weight you're carrying or diabetes you want to reverse, go to getwildfit.com. Go there. And I think the simplest thing in the world is just go straight to the Try WildFit page where you get to try the program for 2 weeks. And I guarantee you by the end of that 2 weeks, you're going to know that it never has to be the way it was before, and you're going to make some big changes. And lastly, you did mention the evolution gap. What I would say is this: the post-diabetic book is an incredibly good breakdown of what diabetes is and why it's manageable and the fact that it is reversible, and then a menu for doing that. The evolution gap is a book that explores the gap between our biological evolution and our technological advancements. And it suggests that almost all of our pain, including things like obesity, type 2 diabetes, anxiety, stress, and so forth, are in that gap. And so I think they make a great pair. And yeah, I'd love for people to get out there and give them a try and give us a review.
Well, great. Well, Eric, it was such an honor to have you today. And thank you for bringing this book out into the world and for joining us today on Passion Struck.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
What an incredible honor that was to interview Eric Edmeans, and I wanted to thank Eric and Hay House for the honor and privilege of having him appear on today's show. Links to all things Eric will be in the show notes at passionstruck.com. Please use our website links if you purchase any of the books from the guests that we feature here on the show. Videos are on YouTube at both our main channel, John R. Miles, and our Clips channel at Passionstruck Clips. Please check them both out and subscribe. Advertiser deals and discount codes are in one convenient place at passionstruck.com/deals. Please consider supporting those who support the show. You can find me on all the social platforms where I post daily at John R. Miles. And you can sign up for our newsletter, Live Intentionally, which has 30,000 subscribers at passionstruck.com. You're about to hear a preview of the Passion Struck podcast interview that I did with Marie Butler. We discuss Marie's incredible journey to becoming a professional bodybuilder and the challenges that she has had to persevere over throughout her journey.
When you're a strong, independent woman and you've got someone who's trying to take that away from you, it becomes deep, deep, deep rooted. So from that point forward, I was on a mission. I was hellbent to figure out what I could do to get my power back. And I started going to the gym again, and I was like, man, I remember what this feels like. This is me. This is what I do. This defines me and who I am. On top of being successful, it was just something. You're successful, and then you look successful, you're even more powerful. So that was just kind of like where that all started. And then I got a wild hair up my rear one day, and I'm like, I'll do a competition, because how hard could it be? I've already done a million bikini contests. I've already been on TV. I've done all this stuff. It can't be that difficult. Little did I know, I hired my coach, and then I learned really quickly what the difference between somebody who just goes to the gym and a bodybuilder was.
Remember that we rise by lifting others, so share the show with those that you love and care about. And if you found today's episode with Eric Edmeans interesting or useful, then definitely share it with those that you love and care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so that you can live what you listen. Till next time, go out there and become passion struck.